You're listening to the Comic Crusaders Podcast. I am your host, Al Mega, CEO of Comic Crusaders and Undercover Capes. In this show, I'm sitting down with creators from all walks of life to talk about inspiration, process, the lessons they've learned, and a whole lot more.
Wepa, mi gente. What's up? This is your boy, Al Mega. Welcome to a brand new Comic Crusaders podcast. And today, we got a fiery one lined up for you guys. Wepa, I can't wait. We have a world-class writer, letterer, editor, and she is the first female writer in Spawn Comics. The first. You heard me right. I can't believe it. Let me bring in this legend. We were chatting about some Brooke now, so she's definitely already a friend of mine. The one, the only, Erica Schultz. Wepa, how you doing?
How's it going? Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, we were talking about picking up burgers in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Heck yeah. You know, it's when you after a good night, a nice yummy burger from Brooklyn, could set you straight, walking like this, you get like this in no time, don't you? I dig it. So again, thank you for coming on, and let's get into it. Let's start digging, Erica. All right. Cause we were having fun in the green room. Let's continue that energy. So again, I know you spoke that you were in Brooklyn, but you're not originally from Brooklyn. So let them know where you're originally from. And most importantly for us, what is the first thing in fandom that you ever fell in love with?
Well, originally I'm from Teaneck up in North Jersey. My parents grew up in the Bronx, so we would go to the Bronx for weekends. And one of the first jobs I got right out of college was in the city. So I ended up getting a tiny little apartment in South Williamsburg. At the time, it was like a mostly Cuban neighborhood. And I would go to the bodega and speak Italian. They would speak Spanish, and we would just find a way to make everything work. What was my first fandom? I would have to say probably OG Star Trek, because my mom used to be an artist for the old fanzines in Star Trek. And I was at a Star Trek convention when I was 3 months old, And I met Mark Leonard, who played Sarek, who played Spock's father on the original show. There's a photo of me as a tiny little nugget. He's holding me up.
So I was about to ask, they hold you, look at that, Wepa's touched by Star Trek royalty. Oh, that is so dope. Okay, so, wow, so your mom was in the country, so I guess this was around you your whole life?
She would do the conventions. There was a couple of friends of hers. There was a big convention that we used to do in New York City, but then there was also a big convention in Maryland. It wasn't in Baltimore, but it was in like a larger city in Maryland. And I remember going to it when I was probably about 6 or 7 years old. And she had these two friends that were in Connecticut, and they would drive down from Connecticut and pick us up in Jersey. And then we would all drive down together. And I just remember like they would do sketches and stuff, and they would meet people, and we would go to panels. And I remember meeting George Takei, and that was really cool. And everybody was just like so fun. And I loved the idea of fandom. I loved the idea of all these people, no matter where you were from, having a love for some type of media, some type of fiction. I thought that was really cool.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. So were you alone outside of your family in your geekiness? Then say going to school and all?
Oh yeah. I mean, my brother would always read comics. I would read comics. I would always, like, my sister and I used to always, like, write and draw stories when we were kids. And I pretty much grew up reading, like, Claremont X-Men, like, with Claremont Byrne or Claremont Lee, or, like, David Michelinie and Todd McFarlane on Spider-Man, or, like, Jim Aparo on Batman and stuff. Ooh. And that's basically, like, what my brother was picking up. That's what I was reading, like, Death in the Family, like, when that first came out. Mind blown, you know what I mean?
All around the way, my God. Great times. And of course, the great times continue. You know, especially with this, absolutely. All right, so people don't start talking smack, man. Business is good. There's a lot of great story out there nowadays. I'll tell you that much. It's just
hell yeah.
I mean, but that's the thing is, I think that's the problem. It's just so much to choose from nowadays that it leaves you like, oh, which way do I go?
At the same time, people who think that they can't get into it, because like, oh, well, I don't like this or I don't like that. Well, because there's so much, there's got to be something out there for you.
There's no way.
Yeah.
Not something for someone. Exactly. All right. So start getting into now your creative journey. When did you start not taking it serious? You said, I want to do this. What first step did you take? And about what time was this? You know, was it early internet, pre-internet, or what was popping?
I mean, I always loved writing and drawing stories. I majored in English in college and I would like write stories and stuff. I didn't think about writing as a career until I was in my early 30s. I was working at a studio in New York and I was doing background art and coloring and animation. And we were working on a couple of different projects. And once we finished a lot of the animation projects, the artist, the main illustrator there was a guy named Neil Adams. And he decided that he was going to be doing a new Batman series, a Batman miniseries over at DC. And that turned out to be Batman Odyssey. So once I was at the studio for that, I was able to see everything on how a comic was made from the beginning, from the inception to the scripting, to drawing, inking, lettering, and so on. And it was just really, really interesting. And so I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, I got a bunch of short stories that I've written. Nothing ever happened with them. Maybe I turn around and take one of these stories and try and turn it into a comic. So I knew that I wasn't a good figure artist. I mean, I could do backgrounds and stuff, but I went up to one of the other figure artists, this guy named Vicente Alcazar, and he was in the studio. And so Vicente, we have a new guest.
Yeah, Bracey has made it.
You made it.
I'm trying to get my headphones to work here.
Don't worry. Where were your headphones? And we're going to continue over here.
So
do without the headphones. Not working.
So I met up with Vicente and I'd written a couple of story ideas and I gave him the script and that ended up being a comic called M3. He said he loved it and we put out 12 issues on our own over the course of about 3.5-4 years.
Wow. So how fun was it doing that creator own joint right there and on your own?
It was a lot of work, but it gives you a real sense of pride when you get it done and you have the book and you're holding it into your hands. Like, it gives you a huge sense of pride because you know every single thing that went into doing that. So Vicente did all the penciling, inking, coloring. I did all the writing, the dialoguing, the lettering. And just to when you got that box from the printer and you're like, whoa, this is, you know, however many months worth of work, but it's here and it's tangible and it's something and it proves that you did it. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, like, the biggest proof for a publisher, especially if you're a writer, because you have to like put your own book out, is finishing it. And I know finishing is like the hardest thing ever. Trust me, I get it, but you have to do it. You have to finish it, because once you get that in your hand, it's like now you have this thing that you can then show people, look what I did. I did this thing. And that's what's so important.
Well, you know, with Bracey here, and he's an independent creator. I mean, you know, how do you feel about that commentary? Because, you know, do you feel the same when you've done your book, Brace?
You know, they say success is 90% of people who show up, and then the rest of it is people who finish. So there's a lot to be said for that. What I find interesting about the process that's going on now with so much crowdfunding is now you are not just an artist. Like when I was first looking to get in, I was just looking to be a penciler, you know, the old Marvel method, you had the penciler, you had the inker, had the old, you know, almost like the Ford factory style things. Each thing was done in stages. You could focus on just being one thing. And now if you're an artist, you have to be a penciler, an inker, oftentimes a colorist, depending on who you're working for. And if you're producing the comic as the writer or the writer artist, you've got to learn a whole other set of skills. You've got to learn about marketing.
Graphic design and marketing, yeah.
You spend time on social media, like all these things that you don't want to do. So like I have the utmost admiration for anybody who achieves all that, no matter if I think like, oh, well, you know, that comic wasn't very good, or if I think it's the greatest thing I've ever seen. You know, hats off to anybody who manages to get through all of that and make it happen.
Yeah. It's a lot. I mean, there's a lot. And like you said, there's a lot of steps involved.
Yeah. Because most of us creatives, we don't want to be business people to start with, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's like tenfold if you're producing something yourself. So like, you know, good on you.
Yeah.
And talk about that journey, you know, creator owned, and then you find, you know, opportunities with Big Two and other independent platforms. I mean, was it an easy journey to navigate to land those opportunities?
Not really. I'll be honest. So when we finally got M3 done, and I had gotten it in the hands of a couple of editors, when we had the first trade paperback, which was the first six issues, mm-hmm. the first story arc, I got it in the hands of some editors and they said, okay, great. Thank you so much. Because for that's my portfolio piece. For Vicente, he could just do pinups or sequential art and show that. And that's his portfolio piece. Mm-hmm. So I got it into the hands of a couple of editors in 2011, 2012. And I didn't hear anything back until 2014. Oh. So I got a call from an editor at Marvel, not the editor I gave the book to, but another editor who said, oh, hey, yeah, this book came across my desk and I'd love it if you could do this graphic novel that we're doing. It's Marvel, but it's also for ABC because they were doing like Castle, Revenge, a couple of the TV shows, Once Upon a Time. So like, oh, so it's not in the Marvel, you know, comics universe, but it's a Marvel comic. Okay, great. So I wrote this comic and I co-wrote it with the producer. He'll never watch this. But I worked on the comic with the producer, and it was a very strange thing though, because I had the producers giving me notes and then I had Marvel giving me notes. And because the producers didn't understand comics and the Marvel people didn't understand that the producers were trying to set things up in this comic for the TV show, a lot of the things that I was getting were contradicting each other. So I literally sat down and I said, like, I don't know who to listen to be honest. Like, think about it. Like, the TV show they have their agenda. Yeah. Marvel has their agenda. I want to be a comics writer. I don't want to be a TV writer. I want to be a comics writer. But ABC owns the show, but my checks are coming from Marvel. Like, it was this real back and forth. And I ended up having to sit down with my editor.
Thing.
Say again.
And you're stuck right in the middle.
Yeah. And so I ended up sitting down with the editor. And I was like, look, I want you to open two windows on your screen. And I want you to see the email that you just sent me with my revisions and the email that they just sent me with the revisions. And I want you to look at both of them and see how they completely contradict each other. And it was frustrating because this was my first real job. I wanted to really impress everybody. And I felt like I was being pulled in a bunch of different directions. I did the best that I could. And I didn't hear back from Marvel for 4 years.
Wow. 4 years.
Okay. Yeah. In the meantime, I had gotten work at Dynamite, and I had worked in 2015. I had worked on a huge crossover project called Swords of Sorrow, and Gail Simone had picked up one of my books at a convention, and I didn't even know it was her when she was buying it. And all of a sudden she starts tweeting like, I just read this book and it's fantastic and I want to work with this person. I'm like, how does Gail Simone know that I exist? And we were laughing about this because we were just in Toronto together a few weeks ago at a small convention. And we were laughing about this at dinner. And I was like, I didn't know that you knew me. And
if you didn't have a chance to go to cons and before the internet, we didn't know what our favorite artists or writers looked like.
Yep.
And so like it's, you know, when you get to meet him in the flesh, oh, so this is the guy. It's not like when you pick up a novel and, you know, the author's image is right.
Yeah, and they've got the headshot on the back. Yeah. I mean, I was just selling a book to someone. That was it. I was just, okay, here you go. Thanks so much. I had no idea. And then it was, oh, okay, wow, she likes this. So Gail brought me on to do Swords of Sorrow. And through that, I got a lot of work through Dynamite. So
She says that she wants to work with you. So what did she hit you up? Who slid into whose DM?
she she sent me a message through, I think it was through Twitter. Yeah, because I don't think I was on Instagram at the time. Yeah. She sent me a message on Twitter being like, hey, I'm serious. I'd really love to work with you. I'm like, holy Christmas. I thought it was a joke. I thought I was like, oh, okay, you know, people, you know, because people talk, oh, hey, let's work with each other, blah, blah, blah. I thought it was a joke. And then I got an email from her and I was part of
fake account.
Yeah, exactly. I got an email from her and I was on a list of a bunch of other creators saying, okay, you know, these are the, you know, there was something like, there was, I think it was like 20 of us or 18 of us. So these are all the lovely ladies that are going to be working on Swords of Sorrow and this, that, and the next thing. And I'm like, if I'm on an email with G. Willow Wilson, oof, obviously this is legit.
It was
just amazing. And that really helped a lot because it got me into Dynamite and I got a lot of work through Dynamite. I worked on Xena and I worked on Charmed and Lady Zorro and a whole bunch of things there.
Because my ex-wife collected the Charmed and loved it. You know, she had fun with it.
My wife loved it as well.
I thought Charmed was such a great show and I loved watching it. And I just did a Charmed podcast not too long ago. And one of the biggest compliments that I got was that they said that you really captured the voice of the characters of the sisters. And I thought that was such a huge compliment because I really loved the show. Yeah. And I wanted it to feel like, you know, a two-part episode from the show.
Yeah. Job well done.
I know you're going into this whole journey here, but I want to backtrack for just a second and ask you something I wondered about. Now, as an artist, you always have your portfolio. Very easy to show. You've mentioned with your own artist there. So did you ever try, before you got rolling and got a couple of your own comics in your belt that got your attention, did you try submitting scripts to comic book publishers? I was just wondering how that worked. Or do you have to actually have a comic before anybody will ever pay you any attention?
You have to have a comic. And I remember it was 2012 San Diego Comic-Con. The first panel that I went, it was the first San Diego Comic-Con I ever went to. And the first panel that I ever went to was Breaking Into Comics, The Marvel Way.
Mm-hmm.
It was Mark Brooks, C.B. Cebulski, Sam Humphries, and Axel Alonso, because Axel was still at Marvel at this time. And because this was 2012. And the first words out of their mouth were, no one will read your script. If you are a writer, no one will read your script. Now, I had in my bag, I had a Batman script, I had a Captain America script, and I had Transformer script, because I wanted to hit up Marvel, DC, and IDW.
Right.
So I had several copies of each of those scripts because if I went to another publisher, I could still give them that script. And I had that. And the only other thing that I had in my bag was a copy of the M3 trade paperback.
Because, you know, that wasn't always the case. I remember like Jim Shooter way back in the day, for instance, he was pitching things, you know, to Marvel as a fan writing letters. And that's the way a lot of people got their start, because I don't know if it's just easier now than it was then. You know, we have all these resources online, but like people would just kind of send in like story treatments or script treatments and things like that, propose ideas, and if you were interesting enough, like somebody would take a shot, give you like a, you know, a little 5-page backup story or something to get you rolling.
Doesn't work like that anymore.
Those days is over. The good old days. Your beard shows that, Bracy Bendito.
No, but that's what I was told, is you have to make a comic. So because we had done M3 already, at the end of the panel, I walked up and I said, and I gave them the comic. And then later at New York Comic Con, later that year, I gave it to another editor. But I opened my bag and I dumped out all those scripts into the trash because nobody wanted to do that. One of the things that I say to people now that they want to get in, you have to start small. One of the best portfolios for a writer I ever saw, it was a 12-page comic. It had an 8-page story, and it had a 3-page story, and it had a 1-page story, and three different artists.
Idea.
Same writer. And it was, you know, relatively inexpensive. It was all black and white, but the art was still great. three different artists, same writer. And it was, because it was black and white, it was inexpensive to make, to print. It had a color cover. And that was his portfolio piece. And it was brilliant. And I will say that I always tell new writers to try to get on anthologies, because you go to a convention and you have a table and you're an artist, all you have are prints pretty much. So everybody's going to have their Deadpool print, their Batman print, whatever. But if you have a book at the table, because you're an artist that works on an anthology, that's something that's going to set you apart. Same thing with a writer. You go to a convention. Yeah, it's an anthology, but you still have a book at the table. And that's important. Also, working on an anthology gives you a lot of really great practice. One, you usually aren't the one having to shell out the money to pay the artist. So that's the first thing. So that helps you that way. Two, you are getting practice in how to deal with deadlines, in how to interact with editorial, in how to watch the process of a comic come together. And that's really important, to learn the process. And one of the things that I will always say is that I have done everything in a comic with the exception of doing major figures. I've done background art. I've done inking. I've done coloring. I've done lettering. I've done graphic design. I've written. I've edited. I have done all of it. And that, I think, makes the fact that I can see and have seen every single step of the process, I think that I am a better writer for it. Like, here's an example. So I was telling Al earlier, I was working on a lettering pass for issue number 2 of Rot City. And I, as someone who has been a letterer, I can look at a panel and say, and then look at the dialogue that I wrote and say, that's going to fit or that's not going to fit.
Right.
Because as a letterer, I can eyeball that. So then I'll turn around and I'll look and I'll say, okay, what of this dialogue is super important and I can't lose it? Okay, that's this line here. Okay, that's got to stay there. I really like this line. I kind of want to keep it. Can I move it to the next panel? Is there going to be room for it on the next panel? Or is it something where it's just, it's totally, it's extra fat. Don't worry, just cut it. But because I have that experience, I can do that. Whereas other writers who've never lettered, sometimes, and having been a letterer, I'll get a giant block of text in one panel and look at this and go, it's not going to fit.
No.
It's not going to fit. And I'll have a conversation with the editor and I'll say, look, you know, what I can do is I can distribute this throughout other panels, but I think we need to maybe pare this down a bit. So I think that that helps me as a writer be able to recognize stuff. Also, I mean, I did a book on Kickstarter earlier this year called Christabel, and I worked with a phenomenal artist named Amagoya Aguirre, and she hates color flatting, and that's literally just drawing in the shapes. And you know, she was doing the pencils, the inks, and the colors. And I said, well, what can I do to help you lighten your load? And she goes, honestly, I hate flats. I hate doing flats. And I said, I could do flats for you. And I did. And I would do color. She would send me the pencils and the layouts. I would approve them. We would have discussions. She would send me the inks. I'd say, okay, you know, give me a day or two. And, you know, we send them in batches, like, you know, 5 pages, 6 pages, whatever. Do the flats, send them back. And she would then render and do, you know, the highlights and textures and really make the pages pop. But I, you know, I helped while I was doing the flats, she was able to then turn around and go and focus on the next sequence of pages.
Curious about the process. Yeah. If you're the one doing the flats, are you the one determining the focus and the mood in the panels, or did she give you little color notes or something?
No, honestly, when it comes to flats, you can put any color in. As long as the shape is there, it's fine.
Oh, so of what course, I visually change the colors pretty easily.
Yeah. So what I was doing was, I was just putting, we had one character who's of Middle Eastern descent. We have one character who's of North Irish descent. So I was putting just, you know, a Caucasian, just a simple Caucasian skin tone, and then she had like a tunic, she had pants, she had a belt, and I would just, you know, color those in you know, she has a, we would always say it was our blue haired princess. So she had, you know, I would always use for flats, I would use a particular blue for the color of her hair. And then I would use a different blue for the color of her eyes. And then for the Middle Eastern character, I had a more reddish brown coloring complexion that I put on him for his hands and for his face and chest. He had very, very bright green eyes that I would always use the same color green, like this, like emerald green eyes that I would throw that in. And he had, he was going a little gray. So he had like a brownish gray colored hair that I would always just throw that in. And then he was a knight and he wore a very red outfit. So then I would put like the tones of red in there. And then he again had a belt as well that I did a different tone, like more of a brick red versus like a bright red. And then what Amagoya would do is she would just, you know, okay, if in this lighting, it should be darker because, you know, it's at night or whatever. And Amagoya would make those changes. But as long as the basic shapes are there, I mean, I could have colored them all rainbows and it wouldn't have even mattered, honestly. So, I mean, I just did it with their basic complexion colors and like the basic palette of their outfits that we had already discussed and picked out just because I had those swatches already available in Photoshop.
I give myself too much extra work because I used to paint, so I still approach coloring digitally like a painter.
So, yeah.
So,
Erica, I got a process.
This is it. We got to know here, Erica, sign.
Yes.
As you mentioned, because this is definitely one of the primary focuses of the show. We're talking about these processes, all this fun stuff, and getting educated.
Which is the end of the spawn, is it?
Yeah, but we got to know about this. Erica Schultz, the first female writer in Spawn comic book history.
Yeah.
Lord me, we were discussing this in the green room, like, really, really? Like, we were like...
I had to look back on it, yeah. And then Thomas, who's the editor-in-chief at Spawn, said, no, you are the first woman to write anything with Spawn. And I was just like, that can't be true. He's like, it is.
It's wild. Wild. Let's talk about that. What inspired this whole creation of this new Spawn set in the future, from what I understand? Things are popping. I mean, tease me because I love it, love it, love it.
Okay. So basically it takes place, the story starts in 2107. And then we jump to 2111. And this is Peter Cairn, the character that you just had. And Peter will become the new Spawn of this era. Peter is not dead. So unlike Al, he is not dead. And I know the original idea was that you could only be dead if you were a Spawn. But then that got changed as things progressed. And as Todd wrote more, that changed. So Peter is not dead. Peter does have cybernetic legs. Peter was in the army, and he and his one friend Reese are the only two survivors of their strike team. And they both came out of their last mission as amputees. Peter lost both of his legs, and Reese lost both of his hands and part of his forearms from this huge accident, which we see, which is this huge double page spread that just Jay Carlos, the artist on this, is phenomenal. And just everything from the textures to the lighting to everything is just so spot on. And it really captures, it's like, what did we say? We said it was like Blade Runner meets Altered Carbon meets Transmetropolitan meets Bylines in Blood, which was a series that I worked on with Van Jensen and Nick A. So it's all these things sort of coming together. So Peter is a veteran like Al. Al was a Marine. Peter was in what's called the United Coalition, which is basically a bunch of, think the UN has now its own army.
Yeah.
And the story focuses a lot on who Peter is, how he became a Spawn. It focuses on veterans issues. It focuses on issues of people, of disabled peoples. It focuses basically a lot of different things from my life I put into this. My father and my grandfather were veterans. My grandfather was an amputee. My father was a veteran of Vietnam. How the government treats you when you return home. How society treats you, depending on whether or not you were in a popular conflict. You know, like my grandfather came home from Germany and got a ticker tape parade. My dad came home from Vietnam and got no such thing. Yeah. So it talks a lot about society. We talk about things that are going on now, like addictions to social media, you know, the way people perceive themselves physically. I mean, think of all the different filters people put on. Wow. You know, we go across like all of this stuff, but it's to the nth degree. So like right now we see social media issues and this, that, and the next thing. This is what would happen if it got amped, just kept going and just got amped up. And that's basically what we do, is we show sort of, I guess you could say, like the worst part of humanity. Like we show like what would happen if everybody's worst instincts were followed through on, you know?
That's terrible.
Spawn you.
So Peter is kind of this reluctant hero, and Peter's friend Reese, and Peter has not really, Quinlan isn't really a sidekick of Peter's, but Quinlan is someone who helps Peter out because they have a link. There's a third person that links the two of them together. And when they both lose that person, the only other person that they have is the other. So they sort of, you know, are bound by the loss of this other person. They're bound by grief. And sometimes, say again, sorry.
Can I ask you a question about that? Sure. Just listening to it almost sounds very much like the parallel between Al and Terry with the, you know, the original Spawn series. They're comrades in arms. They're linked by, you know, Al's wife, although it's separated by 5 years when he comes back. So have you got a similar situation going on here? Was that some inspiration or just?
No, there's not going to be a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. But there is a friendship, and there is kind of, to a certain extent, there's almost a mentorship, because Quinlan is in their early mid-20s, and Peter is already in his late 30s, early 40s. Wow. So there's a bit of sort of like, you know, and also, I mean, there are secrets that Peter keeps that Quinlan is going to purposely, you know, dig out of him for possibly, you know, not nefarious reasons, but for their own personal reasons and stuff. There's a lot. I mean, and this is not going to be like a short 5-issue miniseries. I mean, I was telling Al earlier, I already finished the script for 5, and then I'm already working on the script for 6, and we're easily going at least like 30 issues on this. Yeah. Originally, when I first talked to Todd, one of the things that he said was, I said, you know, how many issues do you want? And he said, well, how many issues do you need? And I said, what do you mean? Because whenever you work at like a Marvel or a DC, they'll say, oh, we want you to write this 5-issue miniseries or this, you know, whatever. And that's the way it is. And I was like, well, you know, I could tell the story in anywhere from 4 to 6 issues, because that's what my brain is sort of focused on. And he says, can you do it in 4 to 6, or do you need 4 to 6? And I said, I could do it in whatever you need me to do it in. And it was this, it was like the standoff back and forth. And
he's like a work for hire, and he's thinking like a creator, like what do you need to tell the story?
And it was really interesting, because I had not expected that. Yeah. I mean, everybody has sort of, you know, their mindset expectation when they meet somebody like Todd, and they think, oh, well, this is how the Zoom call is going to go. And one of the things that he said was, you know, well, if you could do it in 6, can you do it in 8? And I said, sure. And he goes, if you could do it in 8, can you do it in 12? And I said, yeah. And he said, all right, well, the pitch that you had given me, which was, you know, 1.5, 2 pages. He says, this pitch is for only one story arc. I want you to come back to me with a second story arc. I said, all right. So I went and, you know, I did some work on it, and I was sending it to Thomas, editor-in-chief. And between the time of working out the second story arc and then sending it to Thomas, Thomas is like, oh, Todd kind of wants an ongoing from you. Whoa. I was like, wait, what? I was like, he hasn't even seen a script for issue number 1. Like, this is way before I even started scripting. And he's like, no, he's like at least 30 issues.
He's like, you're in, kid, just get it done.
And I was just like, well, but the interesting thing is then I have to change my thought process. Mm-hmm. Because I'm used to, my mindset is always, you're going to get 4 to 6 issues to tell your story, tell it, and then run away because nobody's ever going to hire you again. So my brain's like, okay, so now I have these 2 story arcs. I'm going to make a third one, but that first story arc, I got to draw out. I have to really, I'm not just pulling things apart. I've got to draw this out. I have to find more layers of things to fill up this space now. And it's been a very interesting way of changing my own process and examining my process, keeping what works for work for hire, but then also switching gears for something else. And I've also been reading a lot of very long runs on things. So like, I love Tom Taylor. I think he's a phenomenal writer, and Nightwing that he and Bruno Redondo are doing together is just mine. I mean, I love Dick Grayson. He's a great character to begin with, but their Nightwing is just chef's kiss. And so I've been reading that and watching how they sort of milk this one story arc and how they sort of make time pass a little longer and take a 24-hour day and make it feel like 24 hours in terms of the storytelling. So I've been reading that and sort of looking into how other creators are doing it, because this is really the first time that I've had this opportunity to just really just go in and tell like a huge story.
I think that's amazing. I mean, and so do you think you're mentally prepped now, you know, with all that?
Oh, hell no. I'm still terrified.
This is going to be the you've ever worked on, right?
Yeah. Prior to this, M3 was the 12 issues. And then I had done a series for Dark Horse and Comixology Originals called Forgotten Home. That was 8 issues. But that was 8 issues at one story arc.
Right.
So this, what I'm doing is I'm trying to like pull things apart and like where issue 6 ends for the first trade paperback. There's some answers that you get, but there's a lot more questions that you want answered. And I already have set up, you know, what I'm going to delve into in 7 through 12. But I mean, it's a lot of work. I got to be honest, it is a lot of work, and it's more work and more research than I think I've done for any character that I've ever worked on. So yeah, it's terrifying, but in that really amazing way to like when you challenge yourself and you really want to do this well. I'm also terrified because, you know, I love Spawn as a character. I think the universe is great. I think that when they started bringing in like King Spawn and Omega Spawn and Gunslinger and, you know, Medieval Spawn's been around for a while, but, you know, when they started bringing in these different things and we've got like Scorched and things like that, I mean, I think the universe is so huge. And one of the things that we keep talking about in, you know, when we're just discussing Rat City is this idea of, you know, when Al set off, technically it's called the necroplasmic detonation, but I call it the God Bomb. But in 300 and 301, when he sets off the God Bomb, it ripples through space and time. So he doesn't even know the ramifications of that action. Mm-hmm. And that is what's going to create heroes and villains in different places across the universe. And I think that that's really interesting. That's a really cool and interesting thing to be able to explore and to have the opportunity to explore.
We cannot wait.
I like that as sort of an origin point. You know, I've seen it a few times in like the New Universe's White event. Or Smallville, they had all the kryptonite crash down and mutate people. And I really dig that idea of like there's a key event that sort of, you know, starts the dominoes rolling. And then we see the unintended repercussions of all that. Now, your character, if I'm not mistaken, is coming from the future. Yes.
Yes.
So are you building that world? Are you allowed to like just world build this whole new segment of the Spawn universe that we haven't seen before?
Yes. That's what Jay and I are doing.
That's one of my favorite things. Like, I love seeing all the world building, and the art looks terrific. I really like the design.
Did you have any input on the design of the character as well?
We went back and forth on a couple of things. Like, again, I'm not like a figure artist. I'm not really a character artist, but I would do like, you know, Jay would send some stuff in, and then there's another artist named Joe Prado, who's Jay's rep. And so we would all just sort of like be on the same Photoshop file and, you know, sketch things and like, oh, well, maybe do this or maybe do that. And when we landed on that design, it was like a light bulb went off. And I think, and Bracey, I think that you can agree with this. Like, when something works and everybody sort of coalesces on it, it's just like, oh yeah, that's it.
Yeah. You know, everybody gets it.
And that's how that was.
Now I'm curious, since he is a living Spawn.
Yes.
Because you're definitely shaking things up with that, which is going to be very interesting. Is the suit still a symbiote? Because Spawn symbiotes can look like pretty much
anything. Crazy twist there.
I can't give too much away. Just know that Peter has nanotech. His legs are cybernetic legs. Mm-hmm. They are nanotechnology. And if you see, they're these like, before the event that turns him into Spawn happens, everything that you see on his legs are blue. And then when the event happens, you can see now that they're green. Mm-hmm. And the necroplasmic detonation, the God Bomb.
Right.
When I say it goes through space and time, it goes through space and time. And basically, Al's essence gets distributed. I'm trying to find a way to say this without giving things that, like, I'm literally like picking and choosing my words.
Idea without you having to say more. I don't want to be the guy who spoils anything.
But no, there is, put it this way. Peter has the possibility of being influenced by Al without Al even being there physically.
Oh,
that's right. Great.
That's I think the best way that I can explain it without actually explaining it.
No, I'm a fan of another popular character within DC, at least popular to me, not many people like him, but I wonder if it's along those lines. You know, he's a hothead himself. You know what I mean?
No, it's
not like Firestorm, but I know where you're going with that.
Yeah, that's got my gears turning because I'm also a big fan of Frank Herbert's Dune. And I was thinking about how Leto II, who became the God Emperor, he gets assassinated, but when he's assassinated, his giant sandworm
consciousness
gets spread out and it goes into all these other sandworms. But like, now I'm thinking with what you said, like, so if Al can unintentionally influence this person and he's disseminated, what else is he influencing, whether he knows it or not?
Well, ooh, that's the thing is 303-01, mm-hmm, Al was doing what Al thought was right. Mm-hmm. But and Todd even said this before I was even brought on the project, everything changes after 303-01.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's canon. That's something that he said well before I was brought onto this. That opportunity from the God Bomb, that God Bomb being set off in 303-01 is what has given me this opportunity and Jay this opportunity to create this world. Because when that happens, everything, when I say like it ripples across space and time, it does. It's like, you know how like back when we were younger, they used to always talk about a hole in the space-time continuum.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that. It has influenced all different places, all different. It's not, it hasn't just influenced Peter in 2111. It has influenced things in the past. It has influenced things in the future. It has influenced things in Al's present. Mm. So it's not just our story that is going to show this. Like, there are a lot of different things that are going to be happening in and out of Rat City, in and out of No Home Here, in and out of Mercy, in and out of all these different things, because there's something that Todd always says is he wants to see the collateral damage. Well, this is a huge thing that Al did. And we can all agree that Al has made decisions that have not always been thought through.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a big one. You know, you had Violator, you had an Angel, and you had a Hellspawn, and you blow all three of them up.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing? You are literally taking Hell energy, Heaven energy, and the Rogue Spawn. You're mixing this all together, and then you are just disseminating this throughout space, time, multiverse, universe, everything.
Go wrong.
But you've really got a wide open playground to build things in here.
Which is scary, which is terrifyingly fun, but at the same time, it's scary because sometimes when you have too much to do, like you have too much space, you get all over the place. Like you need bumpers, I think, sometimes. And that's where a good editor comes in. A good editor sort of like keeps you within your lane, you know?
Because now you've got this nearly 30-year-old property, and now all of this is sitting on your shoulders. Yeah, no pressure.
No pressure. I mean, and that's the thing is like, even like you could pick up Rat City and have never read, you might never know who Al Simmons is. And you could pick up Rat City and we will make it accessible for you. But the people that are going to be picking up Rat City are the people who know Al Simmons, who know Terry Fitzgerald, who know Wanda Blake, who know Cyan, and all the characters, and Jason Wynn, and all the characters that go into it, Cygor and Freak and everybody. So I want this book to be accessible to everybody. But I know the first people that are going to pick it up are the people who are fans of Spawn.
Well, and I'm very get that. Say that though, because you know, a quote that I hold near and dear is Stan Lee saying that a comic is always somebody's first comic.
Yes, and Jim Shooter used to do that when he was editing, and he used to always make sure that every comic was accessible to the first person who picked it up.
Yeah. That's a very commendable approach right there.
Yeah, and there are people that'll say to me, like, I'm a huge fan of your Moon Knight. I want to mm-hmm. pick this up. And I'm like, all right. Or, I mean, I've written several YA graphic novels, and they'll say, oh, I'm a huge fan of your Mandrake, or I'm a huge fan of Forgotten Home. I want to pick this up too. Yeah. I mean, if you're picking it up because you're a fan of my work, great. If you're picking it up because you're a fan of Spawn, great. If you're picking it up because you're just curious about it, or you like, you know, Blade Runner and that futuristic, like, where does the world take us kind of thing? Great. I want everybody to be able to find something in this, either in Rat City or one of these new books, because there are some that lean really horror. There are some that lean very future. There are some that lean sci-fi. There are some that lean, you know, sword sorcery. Liam Sharp's doing a medieval Spawn that's phenomenal, and he's writing and drawing. So yeah.
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 Spawn Universe is just digging deeper into my pocket, and I have no choice but just throw the wallet. Yes, I got to
get, you know,
such a big Spawn fan, like you don't even know. But I love this approach so much because, like, one complaint I used to hear as I got older is, like, you know, after the Marvel and DC comics have been around, people would like, oh, I don't know where to jump in. But I never had that problem as a kid. I could always pick up a comic, and specifically with Marvel comics, they were really good at sort of like getting you into the story. And, you know, they had that nice little blurb at the top that would get you in and give you just enough to get started. But even in the context of the story itself, you would understand, like, say, who Peter Parker was, what he could do, and the important people around him, and what was going to be a problem for him. And that happened consistently every issue I ever read from like the 70s forward. So I really respect the approach you're taking there. And understanding like who's going to come in already, whether, you know, it's a Spawn fan, but, you know, you always want those new people coming in to check things out.
That's and nice. I said this to Al before, I think Spawn is a great character. I think that when Image first came out in, you know, 92, 93, it was groundbreaking. It really was. And it was a huge deal. And, you know, I have an Image book. Deadliest Bouquet is an Image book that I did, you know, so even having a small contribution to that is important. I think that, and I think that there are comics out there for everybody. You know, Al was saying, like, there's so much stuff out there that it's hard to pick everything. But at the same time, because there's so much stuff out there, there's something for everyone.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, the Spawn universe in general has been, you know, expanded upon so much that even somebody who might not be like really into the original Spawn stuff, they might find something in these, in the newer stories and in these new the expanded universe, for lack of a better term, they might find a book that they like. Like I said, there's going to be horror. There's, you know, all kinds of stuff. Focus, who's the superhero character. There's Western with Gunslinger. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much stuff to just bring in people from everywhere to say, hey, there is a Spawn book for you.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you get, what, Jimmy P on Gunslinger?
What? Right? Like,
Jimmy Palmiotti's going to be on Gunslinger.
You know, he's famous for, you know, that awesome Jonah Hex. So, you know, he kills Western. So, you imagine.
Exactly.
He's gonna smash him. Like, you know, I got to give this to Todd. Like, decisions he made early on, I thought were a little weird, but they ended up working. And they were very enriching for the property. Like, when he put out the Sam and Twitch book, it was like, you've got this amazing, fantastic character, and you're doing things that are horror, you're doing things that are superhero, you're doing things that are fantasy and even sci-fi, you know, with Cygore and Overkill and things like that. But like, you're going to do a detective book? Like, what the heck?
And they're,
like,
well, they're doing more Sam and Twitch Case Files.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really, really good. It was shocking to me how good it was. But, you know, he's got a broader vision than a lot of people, I think, might give him credit for, because, you know, he's really known just for Spawn now and all of his toys. But he's done a lot of interesting things within there, like even bringing in things like, you know, the Crow for a time, or Kiss the Psycho Circus. Mm-hmm. And like now with 300 forward, expanding the Spawn universe in an entirely new way. And you get to be a part of this new legacy. How?
Nope, no pressure.
That.
Love it.
No pressure.
Time.
Okay, Erica, before we go, you know, I really want to thank you for your time. Just as a fan of comics and the industry, you know, you are an awesome creator. Thank you for sharing in your creativity with us and kicking ass on everything that you touch. And I'm excited because you're saying you're scripting far ahead of the issues, and one is not even out yet. So that means, folks, we're getting this on time. All right. Well, I can't wait. Erica, any last words for the folks out there trying to step into the game today?
Honestly, if you want to work in comics, you have to figure out whether you want to do this as a profession or you want to do this as hobby/side gig, because there's a very different path. If you want to do it as a hobby side gig, great. Start making comics today. If you want to do this as a profession, I would say as a writer, maybe look to take some classes in script writing. If you want to be a comics artist, you can also look into classes, Comics Experience, the Kubert School. They all have online classes that you can take. I used to teach writing at the Kubert School, so I know that they have good quality stuff, because they might still be teaching from the textbook that I wrote. But definitely understand like where you want to go with this. Everybody's like, I want to make comics for a living. That's great, but just know if that's the path that you want, you have to be very, very focused, and you have to understand that a lot of people are going to say no, and a lot of people are going to reject it. But also understand that when people try and give you constructive criticism, to take it and think about it. Because the first thing somebody says is, this isn't working. Oh, screw you. You don't understand, blah, 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 whatever. No. If they're saying it sucks and they're not giving you a reason, that's one thing. But if they're saying, this isn't working, let's try and figure out a way that this can work. That's someone who wants to help you, who wants to help your vision be seen by everybody else. And as creators, we get so in our own heads that we don't always realize that if it's not on the paper, that the people, they're not inside your head. They don't understand what's going on. Like, you have to explain to them, this is this character, this is their motivation, this is the world that they live in, and this is what's going to happen to them. You have to give that to them. Don't hold your cards so close to your chest. Not everything is so precious. And I think that that's really important. But in terms of getting into the game, you know, you can write, you can draw, you can do it. Not, you might not be able to do it as a professional, and you might not be able to do it and make a living out of it. But if it's something that you enjoy doing, don't put pressure on yourself. And that's basically it. If you want to be, do it as a professional, then obviously, yes, there's going to be pressure and there's going to be deadlines and everything. But otherwise, you know, just create and put stuff out there and see what works and see what doesn't. In terms of what's coming out, I've got, today is November 28th. I've got Marvel Zombies coming out tomorrow on the 29th of November. Ooh. I've got Daredevil coming out the 13th of December, and that's going to be a 4-issue miniseries for Gang War. Daredevil is going to go through, and then Rat City comes out in the spring, and I just finished the lettering pass on issue number 2, so all the art for issue number 2 is done, and I'm really excited.
My very final question, I know convention season over for you, or you're doing LA this weekend?
I am not doing LA. Convention season is over for me for 2023. As of right now, the only conventions I have set for 2024 are Lexington, which is March 7th through 10th, I believe, and New York Comic Con, which is, I want to say, the 15th to the 20th or the 16th to the 20th in October. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about San Diego just yet. They, for some reason, rejected my pro badge. I don't know why.
How dare they?
I'm like, if there was ever a year that I'm putting out stuff, it's this year.
Right. You know?
But they rejected my pro badge. I don't know. I sent them an email. I asked them to help me out, and they haven't responded. So, oh well. But yeah, so Lexington, and definitely New York, and then we'll see.
It's crazy.
What are you doing in San Diego? You need Erica over there. Trust me, with the spawn business is gonna be crazy.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if Todd can just say, you know what, screw it. We'll get you in on our badges. So
all Todd got to him is, you know what, that we're not all going. I forgot about it. We gotta make it happen. Everybody, the whole family go. Make it happen, folks. You know what?
They don't call him the Todd father for nothing. He's gonna make it happen.
Exactly. Yeah, he'll put in a couple of favors, you know. Right there, folks. Please check out our link. Follow her on the socials. You know where you can find all the stuff? At Linktree, Erica Schultz. Link is below. Show the love. You know what I mean? Buy that Marvel Zombies. It's dropping tomorrow. All right? Go to your new comic book shop. And, of course, put Rat City on your LCS, you know, radar. Let them know you want every single issue of not just, of course, Rat City, but everything coming off through the whole new Spawn extended universe. All right? Erica, once again, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you. And I cannot wait to dig into this new chapter in my homie Spawn universe. I cannot wait. Seriously, I'm excited. And with that, mi gente, you know what it is. I just told you what to do. Follow my man Bracey on, you know, at Bracey452 on Twitter. He's on Cinema Crusaders. And check out his awesome reviews on Comic Crusaders website as well. He did a dope one for Loop Track. You want to know about that one, all right? Check it out. Hasta la próxima, mi gente. ¡Wepa!
Thank you for listening to the Comic Crusaders podcast. If you like the content, please subscribe and turn on notifications. Also, please visit ComicCrusaders.com and our extended podcast family over at UndercoverCapes.com. And also, make sure to download the Comic Crusaders app on the Google Play Store today.